ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson is making
rise.
Its one nation.
This is the unlikely story of one nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The Making of One Nation. To hear the full series, search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen.
Andy Burnham may be a working class hero, but is a change of face and style enough to stop the rise of right-wing populism that's sweeping Britain? Voters say they no longer know what Labour stands for.
Is Andy the man to show them? I'm Latika Burke.
And I'm Laura Tingle. Welcome to Global Rome.
Laura, 10 years just about to the day since the Brexit referendum result, and the UK is going to usher in its seventh Prime Minister in those years. Unbelievable.
It's extraordinary. It's making Australia look positively stable, Latika, is all I can say. But of course...
Well, as one of my European friends observed to me, it's making Italy look like the beacon of stability.
Also true. We've got this happening on the Labor side for the first time. Keir Starmer becomes the shortest serving Labor Prime Minister to date. All the change to date has been on the Conservative side, of course. What's the timeline now, Latika, for where we go from here?
So it really depends on a lot of moving parts. And one of those is whether we're going to see a contest or a coronation. And that essentially means that Labor's National Executive Committee, they will start nominations on the 9th of July. And until the 16th, any Labor MP can put their hat in the ring. Now, they do have to have 81 signatures of the PLP, so the Australian equivalent of the caucus, to back them in. Someone like Andy Burnham, he's already got 200. But to be honest, I think the crown is already being polished for him because this is looking increasingly like a coronation. There was a really important moment just after Keir Starmer resigned when Wes Streeting, who was the Blairite cabinet minister and a very outstanding performer, widely considered to be a leadership contender and himself very ambitious, he had quit cabinet as the health secretary, become a staunch critic of Keir Starmer and set out his own leadership agenda. Well, just after Keir Starmer resigns, he throws his towel in and says, I'm backing Andy Burnham and so should the party. And I think that's really the sense that the entire party will have now. It is, Laura, an Australian-style knifing, but I think it's more prolonged but probably less bloodless than, say, the Kevin Rudd spill.
And does it get sort of shortened if it's a clear coronation? If nobody else is going to run and it's clear at some point, have they got any capacity to shorten it? Because otherwise we're looking at this long period before you actually get a new Prime Minister, which is not good for anybody, including, dare one say, the country.
It's not, but it would give Andy Burnham and his team time. And perhaps that's something that they could look at Keir Starmer's first 100 days, for instance, in office and say, how do we do it better? We've got this big, big dramatic reset moment. Maybe we could have this time while Keir Starmer remains caretaker Prime Minister. I tend to agree with you. It doesn't look so tenable and it's going to be very odd to see things like the Ankara summit in Turkey, for example, at the start of next month. Who's going to be representing the UK? Is it today's chopped liver in Keir Starmer or is it the Prime Minister of the UK incoming that everyone really wants to know some key questions around his policy agenda, particularly on defence and security settings? So you're right, this inertia for now, it is a problem for the UK. To answer your question, though, it all, again, depends on just where the Labor Party ends up, say, by the end of the week. If it's very clear there will be no other candidates, you might see them try and move or install Mr. Burnham much faster.
And, of course, the big question is, what does Andy Burnham actually stand for and how does he give himself space? Now, I suppose I look back once again to Australian experience. Paul Keating basically eventually knifed Bob Hawke just before Christmas and was able to have a couple of months to regroup the wonderfully, in retrospect, named One Nation statement, where he completely overturned everything that we thought about him. Malcolm Turnbull, by comparison, made the big call and then catastrophically locked himself into these commitments to the Nats and couldn't move. The commentary out of the UK in the last 24 hours has been to the effect that Andy Burnham has locked himself into the Starmer agenda. But, you know, is there something to be said for actually saying, actually, the times have changed, you know, we can change? I know Nigel Farage is out saying, well, we didn't vote for a Burnham Prime Minister, but that, I think this too will pass. What's the capacity for him to really change what he's standing for and what the Labor Party is standing for in the UK?
I mean, this is the fundamental question, and I'm fascinated to hear about that Paul Keating analogy, turning everything upside down and suddenly showing this new side of what he stands for. I think that's probably the best comparison to make to the situation in the UK, as opposed to, say, Malcolm Turnbull or some of the other spills in Australia that we saw, because this is actually a moment where Andy Burnham and the Labor Party, by the way, let's just not make this, let's just pause and actually remember, you know, politics is not just about the front man, although we've turned so presidential in our style. It's a real challenge for the UK Labor Party to make good on the mandate they were given with this huge majority just 2 years ago. But unfortunately, and as I've been saying a lot on Global Roaming, Labor didn't go to that election with a clear agenda. This is the time to go now with a very bold and radical agenda. But Laura, there is very little, or it's scant, detail about what Andy Burnham actually stands for and really how he's going to address the fundamental problem in the UK. It's a low-wage economy. There's not much economic growth. And the dependence on welfare is extremely high. There's an expectation that that continues. At the same time, we've got a geopolitical situation that's extremely dangerous and putting a lot of pressure and demands on security spending. So it's really, really troubling to see how Mr. Burnham is going to do any of those things better than Mr. Starmer, because Sir Keir had a go and he's obviously failed in those 2 years, according to his own party. This is obviously the central challenge for the new Prime Minister and the wider Labor Party movement to ask itself.
Which brings us to our guest today. Don Crittis has served as Labor MP and policy chief for 23 years and has recently published a book, A Century of Labor, 100 Years Since the First UK Labor Government. And it's a book that sets out the battle of ideas that have shaped Labor from Clement Attlee to Keir Starmer. So, Latika, I caught up with John a little earlier and I was really interested in his impressions and views on Andy Burnham's past, present and future, given their long association and where he thinks we may go next. John Crittis, you stepped down as a Labor MP in 2024, and at that time you said that Labor wasn't doing enough for working class communities. Do you think that that's still a relevant comment? And is Andy Burnham's leadership an answer to that problem?
I think to the latter, definitely it is. I mean, he's just been elected in a constituency in the Northwest where he managed to unite the left and defeat Reform UK in what is their safe territory. So it was an extraordinary political feat. Arguably, only Burnham could have pulled it off, actually. And the reason why it's so important is because literally the Labour Party was being destroyed over the last couple of years. And I don't say that melodramatically. I think empirically, you could look at local election results. We've had epic collapse in support for Labour, and we were facing an existential challenge in terms of our very existence. And that's why everything has shifted so dramatically, because Burnham has pulled off an extraordinary feat.
Well, it's pretty wild. And of course, we've got our own sort of recollections. I was a political reporter in Australia for 40 years and lived through all of our prime ministerial transformations. I suppose the thing that's been hard to grasp from here or get a really good handle on is that the sort of the relative importance and weightings of the fact that Andy Burnham is a good communicator, he's a great advocate, and the extent to which what he represents is really important compared to Keir Starmer. What's your reading on what actually happened in that by-election?
First, I've known Andy Burnham for nearly 30 years. And when Labour under Tony Blair got elected in 97, I was in Downing Street and he was in the Culture Department. So our paths have crossed many, many times. And he's really evolved as a political personality. He's created quite an inclusive political culture. He's not factional, in contrast to the Starmer leadership in Westminster. He's a very decent guy. He's very relaxed in himself, highly personable, genuinely authentic in terms of who he is. He hasn't changed in all the times I've known him. And he cuts through at a time where people are desperate for that form of political authenticity and political characters. Because put this bluntly, this week is 10 years on from the Brexit referendum. And we've had 7 prime ministers in that period. You know, there's a sort of revolving door in the front of Downing Street. Everywhere, the pollsters tell us they are desperate for something different. And Burnham has supplied something qualitatively different to what we've been experiencing over that last decade. Now, the stakes are really high because this is, in one sense, it is the last roll of the dice for the Labour Party. We're very fortunate to have a candidate like Burnham, and I think he can rise to the challenge because he has proven himself agile as a political character who has evolved over time. There are jokes, and he's put down by saying, you know, he's elusive and you can't pin him down. I see it as a maturity of an evolving political character over time. And he's taken extraordinary risks over the last month or so. And all credit to him for doing that, because he believes in the Labour Party institutionally. And I think he sees himself as a saviour for an epic moment in our history.
I mean, the UK Labour Party has been through these quite violent swings. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, it sort of from Corbyn to Starmer, and as far as I can see, Andy Burnham is somewhere sort of in the middle, if you like. But at the same time, as you say, it's 10 years since Brexit. There's a lot of pieces around in the international media, a piece in the New York Times, which was talking about, you know, the fact that it's basically not been a great 10 years for the British economy, and a really fascinating graph on migration numbers, which point out that, yes, there's been a surge in non-EU migration, but of course, EU migration's been sort of tanking for obvious reasons, which hasn't been to the interests of the UK. How does Andy Burnham sort of square the circle on this? I mean, if once again for Australian listeners, I can bring it back to Australian politics. Paul Keating was the great sort of fiscal slasher, if you like, treasurer. He eventually took on Bob Hawke. He, in the midst of a recession that many people would say was completely his fault, he recreated himself as a great fiscal stimulator and said, look, the times have changed and I have to change. What capacity is there, do you think, in the British electoral system and in the sort of institutional structures of the economy and, you know, and British government finances for him to sort of say, actually, we're going to do something really different?
Obviously, it's not comparable, our different electoral system, but Andy has shown himself that his ability to work across the aisle in a non-sort of tribal way, which I think will be a premium in the years going forward as we try and deal with populist right. We've got 2 populist right parties, Reform UK and Restore GB. Obviously, you have your One Nation emerging in a very, very strong position. That's going to be the outstanding challenge of our time, to unite and create a counter-narrative to one of dispossession, decline, impending civil war, massive cultural contests. And that's going to be on Andy to speak to a different type of nation building, if you want. And it's going to be in pretty tight circumstances economically. There's not going to be that much room to manoeuvre. You're obviously going through quite challenging NDIS and tax changes. We're going to have quite a challenging issue in gripping welfare. That's going to be a massive issue for an incoming government. We also have a set of fiscal rules that hem in the Prime Minister and the Chancellor. His choice of Chancellor is going to be one of the first big tests that he faces, because he's assembled a very wide coalition. How deep it is, well, we'll see, because some of these clutch calls he's going to make on some of his appointments are going to be difficult to handle. And arguably, the fallout from the Starmer premiership is he never managed his bench. So it became really, raucous and challenging to him, which meant that he was flip-flopping regularly. Unlike someone like Albanese, who seems to be pretty much in control of his backbench so far. And that's going to be a big challenge for Burnham. So there's a whole series of moving parts. There is a question about whether he'll call a election in order to gain some mandate. This will become an emerging issue, I think, over here in the months and years ahead. He's a bit untested, some of the foreign policy challenges that we're going to have. Obviously, the world's in a tumultuous environment, and how he navigates that is going to be very big. He's consciously stood in the most difficult terrain, which is the front line in the national battle against the populist right. And he's come out of that with a resounding victory. There is a sense that populist right are, they're in a bit of a brittle position at the moment. They've had a few backward steps recently. But I don't underestimate the fiscal challenges that the Burnham administration is going to face. But I also know he is a consummate politician, unlike arguably Keir Starmer, who was a bit of a blow-in politically, who didn't come up through the factions and the political and intellectual traditions of Labour. Burnham definitely does. So there are reasons to be cautiously optimistic going forward.
So there are a couple of sort of structural choices he has to make, which are really big calls. The first one is the question of who he chooses as Chancellor. What's your feeling? And, you know, most of the names won't necessarily mean much to Australians, but nonetheless, who is it? And if you have a feeling for that, what do they represent and what would they say about the sort of Prime Minister's premiership that he would be bringing to the UK?
This is one to keep your eye on, because the candidates, one is a guy called Ed Miliband, who had been Labour leader from 2010 to 2005. He worked for the Chancellor Exchequer, Gordon Brown, during his extraordinary successful period in number 11 Downing Street. So he's got a strong pedigree. The present Home Secretary is a woman called Shabana Mahmood, probably the other big standout success as a minister in this government. There's also a guy called Wes Streeting, who's been Health Secretary. He walked out and challenged Starmer, or threatened to challenge Starmer, but never quite came up with the numbers to do it. But he's been in conversations with Burnham himself. I personally would prefer Miliband. I think Miliband has the pedigree, and he is a proven public servant in terms of delivering in office in challenging environments. But I can also understand the counter pressures on Burnham to try and balance the ticket going forward.
What about reform? I mean, some people were sort of saying, well, this is a huge setback for them, but essentially their vote wasn't that different in this by-election to the one they got before. It was just the Labor vote was so astonishingly large. Are there areas where you think Andy Burnham, presuming he becomes Prime Minister, should concede to reform or needs to neutralise reform particularly? I mean, are there particular things where you can knock the edges off the reform argument?
Yes, I think there is an opportunity for Andy going forward. We had what we called a Boris wave of net migration, which approximated 1 million per year at its high watermark, is now down to below net, under 200,000. It's collapsed, and it could go to net zero, if you want, for the next few years. That creates a sort of opportunity for a reset around politics of immigration. And Andy has spoken about some of the reforms that our Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, is making, that he accepts the opportunity for Labour to be heard again around questions of migration, if he can deal with the question of what we call the small boats crossing here, which are about 40,000 a year we have people coming in illegally. And if he can deal with that and close down some of what are known as asylum hotels in terms of the accommodation afforded to illegal migrants, then I think people will look again at Labour around the question of migration. But it's going to be a big call on him to do that. So there's a bit of a weather break, if you want, that could allow for a reset around the politics of migration going forward. And if that is achieved, and if living standards continue to rise, wages are rising higher than inflation now, if that can continue for the next few years, you can see a combination of forces that can create a different environment for Labour to be heard again with the electorate, especially in communities like Makerfield, because I think Burnham has the personal ammunition to do that. He has the ability to take the argument to Farage. He can make big arguments about the direction of the country, which Starmer could never do. Question is really whether Burnham will get a hearing, whether what works in Manchester for Burnham is transportable outside of the Northwest.
What do you think really punched through in that by-election? In a sense, if you were trying to look at something that would translate, I mean, obviously populists tend not to actually have many policies. You know, they have slogans. I mean, is there any appetite at all in the broader British electorate, do you think, for sane arguments about sane policies as opposed to just slogans?
What I think worked in Makerfield was Burnham was literally saying, tacitly saying, vote for me and I'll get rid of the Prime Minister. Vote Andy and get rid of Labour in Downing Street and get me in. And it was all about voting Andy rather than vote Labour. Now, that is a real high wire to stay on in terms of how that plays out. And arguably, he has got rid of the Prime Minister. He wouldn't frame it in these personal ways, but that is the collateral effect is he got on a train coming down with a mandate from Makerfield, and at the same time, the Prime Minister was announcing his resignation on the steps of Downing Street. And bear in mind that he's been the shortest inhabitant of Downing Street in history. I mean, it's an extraordinary collapse in terms of a squandered period in office. I don't think you can put it any other way. But Burnham has rolled the dice, and he said, I will change both the Labour Party and the direction of this Labour government going forward in a very dramatic way. Now, that is a big call that he has to deliver on.
One of the things that's most interesting, of course, is we've got this extraordinary backdrop of international chaos going on at the moment. You know, at a time when you're Andy Burnham, you're trying to suddenly translate into a sort of a national stage in the UK. How important is that international uncertainty, do you think, or could it be, in the sense of if he took a big stance on Donald Trump or, you know, sanctions on Israel or sanctions on somebody else or saying, oh, you know, we're going to undo Brexit, but taking a sort of different, a very different foreign policy position, would that be something that would actually not really matter because the issues are just too hip pocket, as we say in Australia, for domestic voters?
Again, that's a very good question. I mean, Andy is pretty untested on international affairs. For many, the standout contribution of the Starmer administration has been on international affairs, especially the leadership shown on terms of Ukraine and not getting caught up in the too tightly with the Iran war. And Starmer has made significant contributions in that area. There are speculation that in some ways Starmer might be kept on in terms of some international affairs. You know, there was a long-term legacy within the Labour Party that damaged Starmer, which was his position early on in terms of the situation in Gaza, set against the legacy of anti-Semitism within the Labour Party. So there was, you know, there are cross currents here in terms of both the internal Labour politics and the wider international situation and the wider questions around the country. I think foreign affairs does have a purchase. Obviously, we're at the 10-year anniversary of Brexit. Andy has in the past suggested he would want to get back into the European Union, but he's hedged that somewhat in the campaign as not as a priority and not as something that's imminent. But we'll see. We'll see around the relationship with Trump. We'll see around the situation in the Middle East. We'll see around the question around ongoing support for Ukraine. These are very big issues, not least a question of our future relationship with Europe, where we are in the preliminary renegotiation of our relationships. We'll see how that plays out. There are huge issues, therefore, that are on the sort of in tray of the next prime minister. And again, he could be prime minister on July the 17th. So this is hurtling towards him very quickly.
John Curtis, it's been really interesting talking to you, and I'm really hoping that we can check back in with you in a few months and see how it's going.
Thank you very much, Laura.
That was John Curtis, a Labour MP for 23 years, which is quite a good innings, and also a major policy exponent within the Labour Party, a great Labour Party historian. His most recent book is A Century of Labour, 100 years since the first UK government, which looks at how Labour has changed over the century and asks what it stands for today. And I think his position is interesting because he sort of lived through the Blair era or the end of that, the Corbyn era, and then into the Starmer era. And You know, he's obviously had a very strong position as an advocate for working people. He's been a critic of modern labour. So it's interesting to see his perspective on where Andy Burnham might take them next. As always, don't forget to send us in your feedback. And we've got a lot of it coming in at the moment, which is good. We always like to hear from you. Here's some. I've been a faithful follower of your show since its first episode early in 2024. I like the spectrum of age-related stances adopted between Geraldine, who is my age on the one hand, and Hamish further down the age cascade on the other. That's one way of putting it. I like the addition of Kylie and Latika, and especially the new and occasional voice of Waleed, all of which brings into focus for me the question of what the profession of journalism in this new world can mean. I've never felt the need for up-to-date news. I scarcely remember the last newspaper I read or the last news bulletin I tuned to. I do, however, continue to consume voraciously the digested opinions and analysis offered some time after the news has become a genuine something to consider rather than the cheap, vicarious attention grab it so often is in the so-called 24-hour news cycle. Pauline wants you to be defunded, then you must be doing something right. Oh, no comment. Graham Warren. Thank you, Graham.
And there's a bit here for me, Laura, not as warm as Graham's comments. Long-time listener, but felt the need to write in after our recent episode on the UK elections. It felt like Latika's own political biases were being displayed in the analysis. So it's easy to say that Brexit was an experimental vote and people are liking voting differently, but it doesn't really hold up to scrutiny. Polls show that the UK would now vote very differently to a Brexit referendum. The question should be asked why the public still support the orchestrator of that vote if it is no longer believed that it has benefited them. Latika also said British Labour has been complacent, didn't promise anything material, and there's a long list of, you can find this easily on the internet, put about by Labour supporters actually, of the things that Labour says they've done, which is including Renters' Rights Act, banning no-fault evictions, Workers' Rights Act, the Planning and Infrastructure Act, starting to nationalise train service, establishing GB Energy funded by £8.3 billion, doubling of free childcare hours and net migration down 80% from the peak. Well, there's a lot there. Firstly, I still do believe that Brexit was an experimental vote and the voting in the May elections would show that people are absolutely shopping around to vote differently than they have done before. That doesn't mean it's a good thing. It doesn't mean I support it. I'm just saying that's an observation. Why they still would reward Farage after Brexit, despite so many now believing it was not a good decision, that is a very good question. And that's a real challenge for the major parties to put. Now, obviously, the Tories led that referendum, led the country into the referendum, so it's hard for them to prosecute. Labour's also got a really difficult balance here. It has many members, including the new Prime Minister, Andy Burnham, and Wes Streeting, by the way, who recently came out and said, I would put UK back into EU. That is a debate that I think is about to take off. And it could even be something that's put to the next election. Not saying that Labour has not had any achievements in the Renters' Rights Act is one that they frequently hold up. Planning and infrastructure is probably the quiet achievement that they will benefit from in years to come, but it's very, very difficult to sell that to the country as it's facing immediate costs and immediate lack of services and an immediate problem with its infrastructure. It's really difficult for Labor to have sold that, even if they're trying hard, which I would argue they didn't do, and that's why they've moved on to dump their chief salesman just 2 years into the job.
Right. Well, don't forget to write to us. We do love your questions and feedback wherever you are on the age cascade, which is a term I'm now going to take up. So please keep it coming. Our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au. Thanks to producer Rebecca Metcalf, supervising producer Kylie Gray, and executive producer Laura McAuliffe.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.